content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Steve Lord from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a half hour of captivating developments in science, medicine, technology, and the world around us, as reported in Discover, the magazine of science. Today's episode from the April 2018 issue of Discover features a brief story on plant genetics, two stories on black holes and Aztec temples, and two longer stories on empty nest syndrome and satellite orbits. Plant genetics through time. Humans have altered their food for thousands of years. Earlier than 10,000 BC. First farmers. Humans begin domesticating plants for food. In the early 1900s, plant breeding becomes science. Sir Roland Biffen crosses breeds to create disease-resistant wheat. Scientists can now select for traits instead of relying just on chance. 1994. First commercial GMO. Calgene, today owned by Monsanto, launches slow-ripening flavor-saver tomatoes. It's a hit with consumers, but soon is canceled in part due to high costs. 1999. Opposition grows. A Cornell University study implies GMO corn pollen endangers monarch butterflies. Experiments by the USDA rebut the finding, but the perception sticks. 2003. Fresh regs. The European Union passes strict rules on GMOs. Many EU countries later ban farming them. 2012. New edits. Scientists show they can edit genes with CRISPR, and it's used on plants the following year. The method outshines existing tech. 2016. No difference. A two-year study by the National Academy of Sciences finds no significant difference between GMOs and non-GMOs in risk to health or environment. Black hole close-up. An Earth-sized telescope will capture the unseeable. Astrophysicist Jean-Pierre Lumet didn't have a supercomputer when he showed the world what a black hole looks like. He just had an IBM 7040 and a bunch of punch cards. He knew from theory that black holes do not emit light, but the material that swirls around them, dust and gas stripped from stars, shines all the way to its inanimate death. Light from that material, Lumet thought, would trace the black hole's shape, including warps in space-time from its extreme gravity. When the fridge-sized IBM spit out results in the late 70s, Lumet used ink and pen to plot out an image by hand. He saw the black hole's event horizon, the point beyond which nothing can escape, and an accretion disk, a gathering of matter siphoned from nearby stars. Although the black hole had just one disk, gravity had morphed its appearance, like a funhouse mirror, into two perpendicular disks. They appeared brighter closer to the black hole, and more luminous on one side than the other. Some four decades later, the basics of Lumet's black hole predictions still stand. But his image and all others are paintings, not photographs. That's about to change. Scientists working with the Event Horizon Telescope, EHT, will soon release an actual portrait of Sagittarius A star, the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. As a backup, they have data on another one in a nearby galaxy called M87. The image could help demystify one of the universe's most mysterious objects, and even help explain how galaxies like the Milky Way form and evolve. The EHT isn't just one telescope. It's a network of 8 radio telescopes in Hawaii, Arizona, Spain, Mexico, Chile, and Antarctica. Astronomers align these instruments to study the same object at the same time. The scientists then combine data from these 8 antennas into one image that looks like it came from a telescope as big as the biggest distance between the telescopes. In other words, they create a virtual telescope the size of Earth. It's called Very Long Baseline Interferometry, or VLBI. But there's a trick to it. According to Shep Dolman, director of the EHT, the secret sauce to VLBI, the thing that makes it work, is that at each of the telescopes that participates in our observations, we have placed an atomic clock. As each telescope stares at Sagittarius A star, the data gets stamped with the atomic time, like it's clocking out a shift. Then scientists line up each bit taken at, say, 5:13 p.m. GMT, with all the other 5:13 p.m. GMT bits. To do that alignment, though, the clocked-out bits must meet in person at a central facility. Researchers usually share their data online, but this job, with its many petabytes, is too big for the Internet. The only way to get the data anywhere is by flying hard disks around, says Dolman. Researchers call this the SneakerNet, and it's the ultimate analog-digital mashup. The team did its first real observing run in April 2017 with the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, ALMA, in Chile. It's a weapon powerful enough to let EHT peer right into a puncture in space-time. Wielding that secret weapon wasn't simple. The astronomers had to combine data from ALMA's 66 dishes into a single recording before they combined it with the other telescope's observations. Still, even with ALMA and nearly a year of analysis time, they haven't made a picture yet. And it's the fault of a whole continent, Antarctica and its South Pole telescope. Astronomers had to wait for southern spring before they could fly the pallet of data out. It arrived for processing at MIT's Haystack Observatory in December. Why is a black hole snapshot worth all this effort? To Dolman, it's about the strangeness of science. These are really the most mysterious objects in the universe, he says. There's nothing that comes close, except maybe life itself. And life itself, at least life as we know it, doesn't know what black holes look like, what happens within them, and what that means for how galaxies form and evolve, or how that birth and growth led, at least on Earth, to life that can look out and learn how its galaxy works. There are very few topics where we say, we just really have no idea what happens at that point in the universe, says Dolman. One of those may be consciousness, and another one is the black hole. The Great Aztec Temple. Archaeologists analyze ruins in the heart of Mexico City. In 1978, utilities workers digging in Mexico City unearthed a colossal stone relief depicting an unmistakable figure, the Aztec goddess Coelhoxki, naked, dismembered, and decapitated after being slain by her brother, Huitzilopochtli, the god of sun and war. Archaeologists realized the carving must be part of Templo Mayor, the great temple of the Aztec Empire, known to lie somewhere below the city center based on colonial-era accounts and previous limited digging projects. The setting had deterred earlier archaeological investigation because the Aztec ruins were buried under functioning buildings, some erected in Spanish colonial times, themselves protected as historic landmarks. However, the Coelhoxki relief sparked such national excitement that archaeologists were permitted to embark on long-term excavations, first led by Eduardo Matos Moctezuma of Mexico's National Institute of Anthropology and History. The government initially allowed the team to demolish 13 buildings of limited historic value. Since then, excavations have continued in fits and starts, in collaboration with construction and maintenance projects. Today, remains of the main temple are exposed for visitors right in the city center, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's a beautiful, lively Mexican scene where you've got modern Mexico City, colonial Mexico City, and also pre-Columbian Mexico, says David Carrasco, a scholar of Mesoamerican religions at Harvard University. The site is so rich that research could go on for another 100 years, says Carrasco, who studies the temple. Some recent spectacular finds are listed here. Temple 7.0. The temple began as a modest structure in the 1300s, but as the Mexica, the ethnic group that came to rule the Aztec Empire, amassed wealth and territory, they enlarged the monument. By the time Spaniards arrived in 1519, Templo Mayor had undergone 6 major renovations, becoming a 10-story pyramid, with earlier structures nestled inside. This latest and greatest phase is the most poorly preserved. Only fragments of the floor remain because the Spanish razed the temple for materials to build their colonial city. Gifts to the gods. According to Aztec beliefs, gods suffered to create life and had to be repaid. Aztec priests hid divine offerings under floors in caches systematically positioned along horizontal and vertical axes that placed Templo Mayor as the center of the universe. The gifts included luxury goods from across the empire, artifacts from earlier civilizations, and the remains of thousands of humans and animals, many sacrificed atop the pyramid during lavish ceremonies. Skull Tower. Between 2015 and 2017, archaeologists excavated a tower nearly 20 feet in diameter, made from more than 650 human skulls. The sacrificial victims, men, women, and children, have gaping holes above their ears, suggesting the severed heads were strung on a rack for public display before being permanently encased in a tower. Colonial-era manuscripts depict a skull rack at Templo Mayor, but this is the first bonafide evidence. Sure, I miss you, but how an empty nest can launch you toward the best years of your life. 6,521 days. That's how long I'd been living with my son when he left home for college. I'd spooned applesauce into his gummy mouth when he was a baby. I'd watched him wobble down the street on training wheels when he was a preschooler. I'd learned to rise on tiptoes to kiss his stubbled cheek when he was a teenager. For nearly 18 years, I'd been there for the big moments and the daily nothings. I'd fretted about him and had fun with him. While he wasn't my only focus in life, he took up a big front and center chunk. We knew well in advance he'd be leaving. My husband and I live in a small town. With aspirations to attend college, our son had no choice but to pack up after high school. On Labor Day weekend, 2016, we drove 4 hours to deliver him to campus. I expected to cry. Surprisingly, I didn't. His dorm room looked clean. His roommate was friendly. The campus had an air of excitement. Although the final hug was long and hard, I was more giddy than tearful. Almost jealous. My son was starting an adventure. He'd do well. But arriving home dampened the enthusiasm. My son's spot at the dinner table was empty. His mattress was bare. It was bedtime and I hadn't wished him good night. Should I text him or give him some space? What would I do without my son? Though our son has all but moved out, my husband and I aren't quite alone yet. We still have a daughter at home, but she's rapidly growing up. In a year, we expect she'll take off too. Once she's gone, physically my life will continue with 2 fewer bodies to navigate around. But after years of mothering, what should I expect psychologically? Will I be throwing a party or falling apart? One possibility is what's called empty nest syndrome, a term used since at least the 1980s. And it's no walk in the park, according to Genevieve Bouchard, an expert in family psychology and professor at Canada's Université de Moncton. Empty nest syndrome is a feeling of loneliness some parents may feel when their children leave home, she tells me. Its top effects are a sense of loss, stress, and sadness. These issues particularly affect parents who didn't have much chance to develop an identity outside of the home, those who cared for their kids full-time or worked outside the home only occasionally. those who relied upon their children to give them purpose. When their kids leave home, these parents experience a phenomenon called role loss. Without being full-time parents, they don't know what other roles to play. They lose their sense of accomplishment, have fewer social activities, and get lonely. While my kids were growing up, I ranged from being a stay-at-home mom to having a full-time job. I definitely have my own interests. So, although I miss my son, I'm happier for his gain than I am sad for my loss. Maybe when the final daughter departing blow comes, empty nest syndrome won't be my fate. There is hope. Bouchard says a number of studies have shown parents are more satisfied with their marriages as empty nesters than they were when they had children at home. One 2013 paper in The Family Journal looked at older adults' intimate relationships. In it, author Joshua Gold, a professor of counselor education at the University of South Carolina, quotes an empty nester who summed it up nicely. "You forget in 20 years of parenting what it is like to choose what you want to do every night," this mother said. "We can cook what we like, or go out to dinner if we feel like it. Our weekends are free to do what we want." This newfound freedom is the flip side of role loss. Children at home mean daily demands, time constraints, and work-family conflicts. But once the kids are gone, parents' roles change drastically. In other words, maybe my post-kid life will be grand, especially since it will give me more time to spend with my husband. For married couples whose children have flown, many of whom still have half their marriages left to go, an empty nest can make or break the bond. Their toughest assignment will not be adjusting to missing children. It will be adjusting to the marriage, Gold says. Studies show there's generally a U-shaped curve of marital satisfaction. It's high in the initial years, drops in the middle when work and parenting sap time and energy, and then rises again later on. If the marriage didn't do a good job weathering the low point, the empty nest may signal divorce. On the other hand, shifting from mother-father to wife-husband can improve a couple's relationship. In general, Bouchard explains, empty nesters are happier, at least in their marital lives, than parents with children at home. A 2013 study published in the Journal of Family Communication backs this up. Mary King, associate professor of communication studies at Bloomsburg University of Pennsylvania, and her co-author, looked at 50 new empty nest couples. "Many of the empty nest parents in our study highlighted the benefits of a childless house," says King. These parents enjoyed advantages like more time spent together, fewer daily responsibilities, greater personal freedom, increased privacy, more time to talk without being interrupted, and rekindled romance. "Perhaps my husband and I, like them, will forge a new beginning." "So far, my main challenge has been to strike a new mothering balance. I know my son has to get things done at school. Do I nag him from afar, or do I let him take responsibility and potentially pay the consequences? How often do I contact him to make him feel supported, but not smothered?" While studies don't give clear-cut answers, Bouchard says the empty nest transition has surprisingly few effects on the parent-child relationship. By maintaining close ties with their kids, parents can help ensure their own well-being. For a 2016 paper published in the International Journal of Aging and Human Development, Bouchard and her co-author spoke with 102 empty nest couples. Parents who said they'd seen or talked to their children within the last 3 days and maintained regular contact were more likely to report their own lives were close to their ideals and life conditions were excellent. A parent's contentment also depends on how the children are doing. Even though there may be a sense of missing someone, the effects of the emptiness stage depend in part on whether parents are satisfied by the way their children have turned out, Bouchard tells me. "So it looks like we'll be okay. My husband and I are proud of our son, and we've already established a regular Sunday night phone call with him, in addition to the occasional text. When our daughter leaves, I'm sure we'll do the same. Heck, our kid's absence may not even be for that long. As Bouchard noted in a 2014 paper, about half of young adults return home for at least 4 months, again throwing home life into turmoil. Maybe one day I won't be wishing my kids were here. Instead, I'll be hoping they take off again, so I can keep rocking in my new and improved life. Orbital Trailblazer. NASA's latest planet hunter is about to forge a new path through space. NASA will be making history again, soon. Sometime this spring, if all goes as planned, a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket will carry the transiting exoplanet survey satellite, TESS, into space. Once in high Earth orbit, the satellite's instruments will scan the entire sky, hoping to find small planets outside our solar system. The main targets are potentially habitable worlds that are relatively nearby, within a few hundred light years. But the mission's scientific objectives aren't the only historic part. TESS also stands out because of the orbital path it will follow around Earth, blazing a course through space that no craft has ever flown. Thanks to the orbit's elongated elliptical shape, says TESS principal investigator George Ricker of MIT, we can stay away from Earth during observations and get close to Earth to transmit our data once every 13 or so days. These and other orbital attributes will get TESS exactly where it needs to be, with relatively little expenditure of energy and money. That has caught the attention of scientists planning future space missions. It's a unique orbit that, if not groundbreaking, is certainly space-breaking. Upon its launch from Cape Canaveral, TESS will circle our planet 3.5 times before zipping around the Moon, whose gravity will then propel the satellite into its intended orbit. The orbit is named P/2 because TESS will circle Earth every 13.7 days, half the period of the Moon's 27.3-day orbit. TESS will loop around Earth twice for every one trip the Moon takes. The satellite's trajectory is also inclined, tipping up at an angle of about 40 degrees from the plane of the Earth and Moon. It's a kind of a magic orbit, which should give us long, unbroken observations for 300 hours at a stretch, because the Earth and Moon aren't in the way, Ricker explains. It's also a novel orbit that we had to develop and prove mathematically. Joining him in this endeavor were specialists at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, which is responsible for guiding the mission, and at the Los Angeles-based Aerospace Corp. Making preparations for a never-before-tried orbit might seem like a normal part of mission planning, but there's surprisingly little variety in satellites' paths. For space astronomy, there are about half a dozen orbits that are typically used, notes Ricker, but none of the standard ones seemed quite right for TESS. The Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, for example, used a so-called L2 orbit, as will the upcoming James Webb Space Telescope. L2 is an orbit around the Sun that moves in lockstep with Earth, from almost 1 million miles further out. But this remote orbit wasn't a practical option because it required a bigger, more powerful rocket than TESS's budget would allow. Ricker's team also rejected a low Earth orbit, such as the one the Hubble Space Telescope follows. The TESS satellite would have had to pass through a high radiation zone, part of the Van Allen radiation belts, multiple times each day, which could take a toll on the craft's sensitive equipment. Heat given off by Earth could also interfere with TESS's measurements. The P/2 orbit keeps the satellite at a much higher altitude, away from Earth's radiation and heat. You can see better up there, just as the views are better from the top of a skyscraper than they are from the second floor. Plus, it takes only a modest amount of rocket fuel to reach the P/2 orbit, thanks to the Moon's gravitational boost. It's the perfect path for TESS to take. But sorting out the intricacies of TESS's orbit, along with other vital aspects of the mission, has been a long haul. Ricker started working on the project a dozen years ago, and NASA rejected the first TESS proposal in 2008. He tried again with the help of Randy Persinger, an Aerospace Corp consultant, and other colleagues. By 2010, they had most details figured out, but still hadn't settled on an orbit. There were a lot of requirements. It had to be big enough, and of long enough duration to provide continuous, unobstructed looks at specific stars, yet still close enough to Earth that the mission's smaller rocket could reach it. Luckily, another member of the test collaboration showed them a 2001 paper that contained the first serious discussion of a high-Earth P/2 orbit. Recker and Persinger quickly realized that this untested, crazy orbit might afford them extended stargazing times, but at a cost. "We probably read the paper a dozen times," Persinger said. "This orbit had never been tried before, but we bet the future of tests on it." The concern was that the orbit could be unstable, since it oscillated in several different ways. Imagine the orbit as a pliable surfboard balanced on a ball that represents Earth, the board's edge serving as Tess's flight path. The oscillations mean the surfboard will periodically swivel from side to side and up and down, wildly changing the direction it points to. And just as the surfboard can roll forward or backward over the ball, so too can the orbit's overall position change relative to Earth, varying by huge margins, up to 10 times Earth's radius. Finally, the shape of the surfboard itself varies as well, getting wider or narrower while maintaining a constant length. Recker and his team eventually learned these oscillations could be kept under control, which hadn't been established in the 2001 paper. "If you set up the initial conditions right," Recker says, "these oscillations will stay bounded, or stable in other words." Their colleagues at Goddard arrived at the same conclusion, using different numerical methods. P/2 would work. NASA officially approved the mission in 2013 after Recker and Persinger earned the support of a scientific review panel. TESS would not have been selected for flight by NASA without the P/2 high Earth orbit, says Persinger. "It's an essential part of the mission." While the TESS crew makes final launch preparations, other astronomers are eyeing its unique orbit. Randall Smith of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory has adopted a slight variant, a P/4 lunar resonant orbit, for the proposed X-ray observatory, ARCUS. It would make 4 trips around Earth for every 1 the Moon takes. And Lynx, a proposed successor to the Chandra Space Telescope, ranked a TESS-type orbit as among its best options. "We're following in TESS's footsteps here," Smith says. "These lunar assist orbits are the new hotness, to steal a phrase from Men in Black." That's perhaps an apt comparison for an orbit designed to help us spot the closest, most likely places for alien life. P/2 and other lunar-assisted orbits may well become useful for future missions, but TESS, to borrow another phrase from Men in Black, was still the first to make this look good. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover, the magazine of science. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. Till then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.